to Historical Nerdery, the show that destroys the myths of the American Revolution one podcast at a time. I am your head nerd, Alexander Kane. In our Season 2 premiere, we'll investigate the struggles and hardships of Massachusetts civilians trapped behind enemy lines during the Siege of Boston in 1775 and 1776. I hope you will join us today on Historical Nerdery. Let's get into the show. Over the years, historians have written countless works on the military and political aspects of the Siege of Boston. Unfortunately, little attention has been given to the impact of the siege upon the residents of Boston itself. As British military and political authorities attempted to recover from the disaster that was the battles of Lexington and Concord, the residents of Boston found themselves trapped inside a town that was on the verge of social and economic collapse. On the evening of April 18, 1775, many of the residents knew a military operation into the countryside was in motion, and as a result, got little sleep. According to one resident, "I did not get to bed this night till after 12 o'clock, nor to sleep till long after that, and then my sleep was much broken, as it had been for many nights before." In reality, many Bostonians were oblivious of plans to seize and destroy a supply depot located in Concord, Massachusetts. Instead, most Bostonians believed the British objective was the arrest of Samuel Adams and John Hancock. As Sarah Winslow Deming recalled, "The main was to take possession of the bodies of Messrs. Adams and Hancock, whom they and we knew where were lodged." Shortly after dawn, word of the Battle of Lexington reached Boston residents. Predictably, fear set into the populace. One woman would later write, "Early on Wednesday, the fatal 19th April, before I had quitted my chamber, one after another came running up to tell me that the king's troops had fired upon and killed 8 of our neighbors at Lexington in their way to Concord. All the intelligence of this day was dreadful, almost every countenance expressing anxiety and distress." As the day progressed, Boston broke into a state of panic. Many residents wandered about aimlessly, unsure of what the future held. In a letter to his son, the Reverend Andrew Elliott stated, "I know not what to do, not where to go. May God sanctify our distresses, which are greater than you can conceive. Such a Sabbath of melancholy and darkness I have never knew. Every face gathering paleness, all hurry and confusion, one going this way and another that. Others not knowing where to go. What to do with our poor maid, I cannot tell. In short, after the melancholy exercises of the day, I am unable to write anything with propriety or connection. Everything distressing." Over the next few days, as the American army surrounded the town and settled into a siege, scores of Bostonians discovered that they were prohibited from fleeing the town. General Thomas Gage was fearful that if the residents were permitted to leave, they would provide material assistance to the American army. As a result, he issued orders barring residents from leaving Boston. One resident openly complained, "I was General Gage's prisoner. All egress and regress being cut off between the town and country." According to merchant John Rowe, Boston's economy immediately collapsed. Businesses stopped operating, and fresh provisions for the market stopped coming into town. Boston resident John Andrews Esquire noted in a letter to his brother-in-law, "It's a fortnight yesterday since the communication between the town and country was stopped. Of consequence, our eyes have not been blessed with either vegetables or fresh provisions. How long we shall continue in this wretched state, God only knows." Boston residents gathered at a town meeting on April 22, 1775, to address their declining situation. A resolution was drafted to General Gage, and it highlighted the level of desperation they felt with the town being shut off to the outside world. According to the resolution, inhabitants cannot be supplied with provisions, fuel, or other necessaries of life, by which means the sick and all invalids must suffer greatly, and immediately and the inhabitants in general be distressed, especially such which is by much the greatest party, as they have not had the means of laying in a stock of provisions, but depend for daily supplies from the country for their daily support, and may be in danger of perishing unless the communication be opened. Representatives from the town voted to approach General Gage to secure his permission for Americans to evacuate Boston. After a tense meeting, the general ultimately agreed to let the residents vacate to the countryside, on the condition that they surrender their personal weapons so they would not end up in the hands of the Massachusetts Grand Army surrounding Boston. Reluctantly, the Bostonians agreed. One minister recalled the state of the civilian populace on the eve of the evacuation. "I am not impelled by the unhappy situation of this town. All communication with the country is cut off, and we wholly deprived of the necessities of life, and this principal mart of America is become a poor garrison town. Almost all are leaving their pleasant habitations, and going they know not whither. The most are obliged to leave their furniture and effects of every kind. Now I am by a cruel necessity turned out of my house, my beloved congregation dispersed, my dear wife retreating to a distant part of the country, my children wandering, not knowing whither to go, perhaps left to perish for want, myself soon to leave this devoted capital. Happy if I can find some obscure corner which will afford me a bare subsistence. I wish to God the authors of our misery could be witness of it. They must have hearts harder than an adamant if they did not relent and pity us." On the appointed day of the evacuation, those who chose to flee made their way to Boston Neck, the sole land route out of town. At least four checkpoints along the Neck were set up by the British Army. Residents were searched for weapons, and carriages and chaises were prohibited from leaving Boston. Some residents pleaded with family and friends not to leave the safety of Boston. However, most pleas were rebuffed, as many believed once British reinforcements arrived in Boston, the town would become a killing field. This belief was only strengthened as rumors of atrocities being committed by soldiers inside Boston quickly spread. Once again, panic set in, and the residents pressed harder to get out of the city of destruction. At the height of the confusion, British officials suddenly closed Boston Neck, and the inhabitants were ordered back inside. On April 27, 1775, General Gage again reversed himself and gave permission for the remaining American residents to leave Boston. Surprisingly, however, British authorities undermined Gage and made it difficult, if not impossible, for Bostonians to leave. Passes were now required to cross over Boston Neck, and their number was limited. Near half the inhabitants have left the town already, and another quarter at least have been waiting for a week past with earnest expectation of getting passes, which have been dealt out very sparingly of late, and those with the greatest difficulty. On May 5th, a large number of passes were issued, and many residents quickly left through Boston Neck. According to one period account, you'll see parents that are lucky enough to procure papers, with bundles in one hand and a string of children in the other, wandering out of the town not knowing where they'll go. The following day, General Gage unexpectedly revoked all outstanding passes once again, declared no more were to be issued, and those who wished to leave Boston were prohibited from doing so. In a letter to her husband, Abigail Adams chastised Gage and other officials for the continuous issuing and revoking of passes, repeatedly changing what personal belongings could accompany the refugees and the resulting emotional stress to the Americans trapped inside the town. The distresses of the inhabitants of Boston are beyond the power of language to describe. There are but few who are permitted to come out in a day. They delay giving passes, making them wait from hour to hour, and their counsels are not 2 hours together alike. One day, they shall come out with their effects. The next day, merchandise are not effects. By the end of May, Boston more closely resembled a post-apocalyptic world than a bustling seaport community. In a letter to a friend in England, loyalist Anne Halton wrote, "A solemn dead silence reigns in the streets. While many had abandoned the town, others barricaded themselves inside their homes and had hired private guards to watch over their property." The Reverend Elliot accurately described the state of Boston on the eve of the Battle of Bunker Hill. "I have remained in this town much against my inclination. Most of the ministers being gone, I have been prevailed with to officiate to those who were still left to tarry. Much of the greater parts of the inhabitants gone out of the town. Grass is growing in the public walks and streets of this once populous and flourishing place. Shops and warehouses shut up, businesses at one end and the other in anxiety and distress." Even the towns on the outskirts of the siege lines were not immune from the effects of the siege itself. According to one observer, the town of Roxbury, which served as a forward American outpost during the Siege of Boston, suffered a fate similar to Boston. Nothing strikes me with more horror than the present condition of Roxbury. That once busy, crowded street is now occupied by a picket guard. The houses are deserted, the windows taken out, and many shot holes visible. Some have been burnt, and others pulled down to make room for the fortifications. A wall of earth is carried across the street to William's old house, where there is a fort mounted with cannon. A row of trees, root and branch, lies across the road there, and the breastworks extends to Lamb's Dam. I went round the hole, and I was so near the enemy as to see them relieve their sentries, which they do every hour. As the siege continued, fresh provisions were increasingly scarce, and trapped occupants were often forced to survive on food of questionable quality. As one account recalled, it is hard to stay cooped up here and feed upon salt provisions. We have now and then a carcass offered for sale in the market, which formerly we would not have picked up in the street, but bad as it is, it readily sells. By August of 1775, Boston resident Timothy Newell noted just how desperate the conditions had become. This morning, 4:30, awoke with a cannonade and small arms from Charlestown, which lasted to 11:00 after that. Very trying scenes. This day was invited by two gentlemen to dine on rats. A few months later, Newell would bitterly complain that there were several thousand inhabitants in the town who were suffering the want of bread and every necessity of life. A few months later, in January of 1776, Anne Holton also noted just how dire the situation in Boston was when she stated, "Provisions and fuel were scarce and very dear supplies uncertain." The combination of British troops, Loyalist refugees, and Boston residents all occupying a small amount of space only exacerbated a very dangerous situation. Press gangs roamed the town looking for civilian men to force into manual labor. Inhabitants were arrested for merely being suspected of espionage or providing aid to the enemy. Many of the soldiers and camp followers abused the civilian population, stole from them, and plundered their property. John Andrews complained that the soldiery think they have a license to plunder everyone's house and store who leaves the town. According to John Leach, Boston had devolved into a complicated scene of curses, debauchery, and the most horrid blasphemy committed by the provost marshal, his deputy, and soldiers, and sundry soldier women. Nor were Loyalist refugees immune from the hardships of the siege. Dorothea Gamsby was 10 years old when the war broke out. In a letter written years later to her granddaughter, Gamsby accurately described just how tenuous the situation inside Boston had become by the eve of the Battle of Bunker Hill. Residents continued to hide in fear and were under constant stress. Most believed that the town would be invaded by the rebels and its inhabitants slaughtered at any moment. As Gamsby recalled the Battle of Bunker Hill, then came a night where there was a battle, anxiety, and watching. Aunt and her maid walked from room to room, sometimes weeping. I crept after them, trying to understand the cause of their uneasiness, full of curiosity, and unable to sleep when everybody seemed wide awake, and the streets full of people. It was scarcely daylight when the booming of the cannon on board the ships in the harbor shook every house in the city. My aunt fainted. I screamed with all my might. As the siege progressed, conditions inside the town continued to deteriorate. Surviving houses of worship were demolished for fuel or converted into riding stables. Loyalist Isaac Winslow noted, "Fuel is now the scarcest article, and to supply the troops, they take down the oldest houses and buildings in the town. 'Tis all a scene of desolation. You would not know your own town scarcely. Dr. Sewell's meeting house has been gutted of pews and galleries to make a riding school for the light horse." As the siege continued, diseases and sickness began to spread inside Boston. The end result was a general sense of despair throughout the surviving civilian population. Some of the common emotional descriptions by residents during the siege included such negative words as anxiety, distress, forsaken, and darkness. Some accounts even expressed what only could be interpreted as hopelessness or borderline suicidal thoughts. One account sadly noted, "Social life is almost at the last gasp." Another account stated, "It is impossible to describe the distress of this unfortunate town. I try to do what business I can, but am disappointed in nothing but cruelty and ingratitude falls to my lot. A final humiliating blow came to the occupants on the eve of the British evacuation of Boston in March of 1776. As His Majesty's army prepared to evacuate the town, British troops and loyalist refugees roamed the streets, plundering homes, warehouses, and businesses of the local populace. According to John Rowe, "They stole many things and plundered my store. I remained all day in the store, but could not hinder their destruction. They are making the utmost speed to get away and carrying everything they can away, taking all things they meet with, never asking who is the owner or whose property it is, making havoc in every house and destruction of all kind." John Andrews recalled how a party of soldiers got into a neighbor's house, went into his cellar, took the liquors from thence, and had a reveling frolic inside his parlor, carried off and destroyed his furniture to the value of 200 sterling, which was not to be named with what 50 other houses suffered, or may I say, 100. Troops repeatedly threatened, robbed, and intimidated the inhabitants. To the horror of many Bostonians, even officers participated in the illegal activities. Following the British and Loyalist evacuation of Boston, American troops entered the town and were joyfully greeted as liberators. Thus was this unhappy, distressed town relieved from a set of men whose unparalleled wickedness, profanity, debauchery, and cruelty is inexpressible. However, not all were sympathetic to the sufferings of the Boston civilian population, particularly the Loyalists. In a letter to a family member, General George Washington, commander of the Continental Army, complained, "But the inhabitants have suffered a good deal in being plundered by the soldiery at their departure. All those who took upon themselves the style and title of government men in Boston, in short, all those who have acted an unfriendly part in the great contest have shipped themselves off in the same hurry, but under still greater disadvantages than the king's troops, being obliged to man their own vessels, as seamen enough could not be had for the king's transports, and submit to every hardship that can be conceived. One or two of the loyalists have done what a great number ought to have done a long time ago, committed suicide. By all accounts, there never existed a more miserable set of beings than these wretched creatures now are. Taught to believe that the power of Great Britain was superior to all opposition, and if not, that foreign aid was at hand. They were even higher and more insulting in their opposition than the regulars." For the next several years, Loyalists and Patriot inhabitants of Boston petitioned the Continental Congress and the Massachusetts government for compensation for property lost or damaged as a result of the siege. Some claims were paid, others were ignored or denied. In the weeks after the conclusion of the siege, American troops moved south to New York City. For the remainder of the war, the residents of Boston were never again subjected to the horrors of a military siege or occupation. Despite its conclusion, the siege of Boston still haunted many of its civilian victims. In 1776, Anne Holton returned to England to be with her family. In a letter to a relative, she declared, "When a solitary hour allows room for reflection, it still appears a wonder to me that I am still here, in my native country, escaped from the dangers and free from fearful alarms, that I can go to bed without apprehensions of cannonadings by which I used to be roused, and rise up without anxious thoughts for supplies and safety by day, and walk out and see plentiful markets and easy countenances, instead of deserted streets, empty marketplaces, or to meet discontented looks and anxious distress." Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Historical Nerdery. To learn more about the Siege of Boston, as well as other neat information about revolutionary New England, be sure to check out my website, historicalnerdery.com. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram, and subscribe to my mailing list. I'm Alex Kane, and this has been Historical Nerdery.